Pulling on the inset handle, I silently inched open the door and let myself in. I intended just to take a quick peek. The room was a bedroom, furnished simply but tastefully. Two chairs, a large double bed, a nightstand, a tall wall mirror, and a mahogany dresser, with a toilet set of pure brushed gold that made me think of Cleopatra, and burnished instruments of rare device. From another room, I heard voices. Looking around for a safe place to hide, I retreated behind an oriental screen that hid a hamper overflowing with soiled clothes. Between the hinged panels of the screen, I could see entering the room the friendly man who had greeted me earlier, and of all people, Lily Gillespie. "I must have forgotten to rewind the clock," he said as he glanced at the table. "If we could just make time stand still." "Yes, we'd live happily ever after." "For a little while," Lily added, chuckling at what she'd said. I was dumbstruck. This fellow was talking about marriage to Lily. But the most shocking thing was yet to come. She reached up and pulled him onto the bed, covering his eyes and nose and cheeks and mouth with kisses. Who was this man, really? From the cut of his clothes, I could see he had dough. There was something here that didn't add up. This wasn't some chorus girl. This was Lily Gillespie, who had wealth, beauty, intelligence, and a college degree. I hoped this guy was special because she already had a dodo at home. In nothing flat, he was returning her kisses, and the two of them were rolling on top of each other. Startled, I leaned against the screen, and it toppled. Lily glanced up, saw me, cartwheeled off the bed and straightened her dress. "Something wrong?" the man gulped, hastily adjusting his clothes. "What are you doing here?" exclaimed Lily. "And your hair! You've had it marcelled. I just love it." Picking up the screen, I smiled dumbly as Lily madly ran a comb through her hair. "I want you to meet an old friend of mine." She sure was good to her friends. "This is Hank Rodman, your host. He owns this glorious house. Hank, this is Henrietta." What in the world had made me think this guy was part of the staff? He never acted like one. I hate it when I dial a wrong number. Obviously, this guy was not what he seemed. He dressed like a swell, but was lacking the starch. And, as I learned later, he ran on wonder and trafficked in dreams. Seeing the way Rodman and Lily longingly gazed at each other, I said to myself, well, given the nincompoop she's married to, I can understand her looking elsewhere. The lovers were like two butterflies, hovering weightlessly over a field ablaze with emeralds and diamonds and shining automobiles, from which glided beautiful women arrayed in satins and silks and smelling of exotic perfumes. In the months to follow, I learned how he had grown rich in a soil made fertile by easy money, and drew breath from an atmosphere rendered romantic by blue gardens and midnight stars casting shadows of silver. The view from his window looked across the bay to the green windsock on the end of Lily's dock, waving to and fro as if to say yes, no. "May I ask you a favor?" said Lily. "Would you be so kind as to forget the scene you just saw? In fact, forget that you even saw us together?" Not that I would have ever blabbed, but I knew I couldn't say no to this woman, not because of her beauty and style, which dazzled, but because of her voice, the way she used it to embrace people and soften her indiscretions. In the distance, we could hear the band start to play. "Oh, Hank! The entertainment's beginning. We ought not to miss it. You must come too, Henrietta." The three of us made our way to the lawn, where dozens of folding chairs had been set out in rows with an aisle down the center. Rodman led them up front to several seats with little signs saying reserved. The instant we sat, the band started playing, and Joe Frisco sailed out wearing a tux and a derby and puffing on one of his trademark Corona cigars. He looked around, tipped his hat to his host, and deadpanned. Nice crowd you got here. It's good you didn't invite any more people, or I'd had to phone in my act. Expressively moving his hands and puffing on his foot-long cigar, Joe started to dance. A saxophone broke into a blue note, followed by the sweet rainbow sound of a clarinet, and then a trombone called a halt to the improvisation with the opening notes of Snake Hips. Joe's jazz dance was often called oozy, probably because of the way he shuffled his feet, shrugged his shoulders, slouched, and negligently moved his arms and hands through the air. To the rhythm of the music, he jerked a hip to one side and broke out in a cakewalk, segued into a strut, and at the end returned to a shuffle. All his movements began at the hips and looked, depending on one's frame of mind, suggestive and also detached. People howled their delight and clapped in time with the music. The louder the hand, the greater Joe's efforts, until finally the act reached its climax, as Joe blew sparks from his cigar and the sax blew a mournful farewell. Frisco left the stage to thunderous applause. Harry Houdini was next. As the band played, I left my seat to join Harry behind the stage in the shed, which smelled of oil and grass. He was already dressed for the show, wearing only a swimming suit and a robe. While he lugged the chains and the locks from the trunk, I carried the folding table and portable cabinet, which I prepared on the stage. Throwing off his robe, he declared that he'd dressed this way in order to prove that he had no secret hiding places, not in his clothes and not on his person. No one asked for a rectal exam, though in years past, Harry had used that avenue. From the way Harry was flexing his muscles and expanding his chest, you could tell that he loved to parade his physique. Holding up the chains and the locks, Harry invited the guests to examine them to guard against fraud. He declared that he would gladly use someone else's shackles if that person wished. A ruddy-faced, freckled fellow, his hair the color of straw, came down the aisle and held up a lock. I dare you to try this one. Harry had to make sure that the lock could be opened, so he asked the stranger to show him the key and prove that it worked. If Harry accepted this fellow's lock, he would examine the key and signal the depth of the cuts on the key. Most key blanks are cut according to a scale that runs from 0, no cut, to 9, the deepest. Harry had only to study the key, and he'd know which numbers to pass on to me. If he decided the lock was beyond his control, he'd find some excuse to reject it, in which case he'd have the audience select one of his own. Checking the new lock and key, he agreed to use it. Next, he gave the crowd his standard line about the meaning of confinement and escape, a routine that immigrant audiences never fail to applaud. But I worried about how this group would react. It's the great human wish to be free, free from our past, from illness, from death, and from the shackles and shame of being poor. That's why millions of people have come to these shores. America, he said, is the land of escape, even for robbers. The audience grew restless. So Harry moved immediately to his challenge. He asked for volunteers to bind him in chains and secure the ends of the links with the lock he'd just now accepted. Several men jumped on the stage. Pinning Harry's arms behind him, they bound him in the long length of chain. All the while, Harry was telling this story. I knew a guy from Tin Pan Alley who did his composing in bed. His name was Corbin. He would write down on the sheets the rhythm of his night's inspiration. A 1, and a 2, and a 8, 4, 6, 4, 2. I mean nothing off color here, folks, but that's why we call it sheet music. Harry had sent me the signal. The name Corbin identified which key blank to use, and all the numbers after a 1 and a 2 were the cuts in the key. I darted into the shed where Harry had set up a portable key-cutting machine and bolted the door. I could hear him inviting people to join him on stage to check the worthiness of the chains and the lock. He was trying to give me time to fashion a key. I quickly found in our collection of blanks the one that he wanted. Notching it was a cinch. Before you could part your hair, I returned, which was Harry's cue to ask for a hug. Ladies and gentlemen, my assistant tonight is my niece. I'd like her to give me a hug, just for good luck. The audience approvingly clapped. Putting my arms around Harry, I passed him the key. As soon as I descended the stage, he excused himself and entered the portable cabinet, supposedly to call on some magic that would allow him to slip out of his bonds. When he emerged completely unchained, the crowd erupted. It sounded like the polo grounds, what with all the clapping and whistling. Free to spend the rest of the night by myself, I drifted at first among the moths and the barflies, gaining here and there a glimpse of romance among the smart set. The band had started up and the stage was now being used as a dance floor. Incense filled the air and candles flickered on the numerous tables that had miraculously replaced all the chairs. One woman, tugging at a man's hand, complained, "You never want to dance. Come on." Another couple was spatting, "I saw the way you were staring at that blonde." The man, shaking his head in amazement, replied, "That dress! She's like sausage meat in a casing. One slice and out she'll pop." An exceedingly angry twosome were arguing. The man called to a fellow dressed in a duster, "Come over here, Eric." The first man poked a finger in Eric's chest and demanded, "Are you or are you not in love with my wife? Admit it." "You're daft," Eric said, and briskly walked off. To clear the spite from my head, I wandered down to the dock. The evening air was cooler the closer one came to the water. A breeze must have been blowing somewhere high above, because the clouds were continually changing shape. From time to time, the moon found a gap and came streaming through, flooding with phosphorescence the sea and the beach, and lifting out of the shadows the silent estates that bordered the bay. I sat there for what seemed like ages, until I heard some motorboats off in the distance. It was shortly before 1 a.m. Four men passed me in the dark and revved up the two speedboats. Sweeping away from the dock, they roared off with their running lights dark. All was still, except for a few muted voices that seemed to come from the sea. About an hour later, a small van drove down to the beach, and two boats glided silently into the dock. Immediately, a half dozen men appeared and boarded the motorboats, unloading wooden crates which they carried towards Rodman's garage. Just then, sirens sounded, and a booming voice came over a bullhorn. "This is a raid! You are surrounded! Everybody inside the house!" In an instant, the lawn seemed overrun with men dressed in raincoats and cradling shotguns. Fragmentary voices cracked through the dark. "Over here! Don't let them get away! The garage and stables! That's where it's stored!" A copper roughly grabbed me by the neck and shoved me in the direction of the house. "Get inside, now!" Streams of people were running toward the veranda, pouring through the open French doors. Led into the library, we stood around like army recruits waiting for our marching orders. "Where's the owner of this pile of bricks?" barked one of the raincoats. His hat tipped so far forward, all you could see was his mouth. The room rippled with whispers. Rodman and Lily were nowhere in sight. "I suppose none of yous knew they was bringing in booze tonight, or about the storeroom under the false floor in the garage." The library fell awfully quiet. "Anyone here got a key to these bookcases?" No one moved. "Patrick," he growled, "break open one or two of them and let's see what's inside." I said to myself, "Books, you dumb bloodhound." Some guy with a fire axe broke the glass and removed several volumes, which he gave to his boss. H.G. Wells, A Short History of the World. Schopenhauer, Essays, pretty strong stuff. Each volume he opened had been hollowed out in order to hold a bottle of Scotland's finest. Chivas Regal, Craganmore, Glenfiddich, Glenlivet, Imperial, the Macallan, Royal Lochnagar, Talisker. There must have been a fortune in booze in the library. But I could just hear my mother asking how anyone could treat a book in this manner. By now, Rodman's guests were overflowing with gossip and glee at having been present for this great unveiling. All the stars but Houdini found it a lark. When the cops questioned Frisco, one of them asked if he always stuttered. Joe replied, "Just when I talk." In short order, the theater people were told they could leave. I was all set to join Harry, who had successfully asked that I be released, when some big shot stormed into the library, wanting to know who occupied the red room with the fishbowl. The other cops called him Lieutenant Sullivan, but the cop with the hat and the growl addressed him as Sully. "It's mine," I said, stepping forward. "Crap! You're just a minnow. Who you working for?" "Harry Houdini." "You can't be serious."
"She certainly is," said Harry, putting his arm round my shoulder.
"Well, I'm awfully sorry, Mr. Houdini. I have no choice but to book her."
"What the hell for?"
asked Harry, who was known never to swear.
"For this,"
replied the lieutenant, taking from his pocket a single diamond. "She had it concealed in a fishbowl, blended in with the pebbles and sand. Damn clever. It's one of the 16 Farouk diamonds. Came from the Waldo Avenue heist up in Fieldston." My teachers used to call me a loudmouth, but I found myself speechless. "We heard that all the gangs now use kids. Sweet deal. Two capers in one. Bring in the whiskey from Canada and pay for the goods with the diamonds. But we got a tip about both. Now the question is, where did the kids store the rest of the rocks?" "Sully, you've got it all wrong," said the man I'd met in the library, the one with the milk and the cake. The crowd, like the Red Sea, miraculously parted. The man walked up to Lieutenant Sullivan, and the two of them warmly shook hands.
"A.R., who would have guessed? Since when do you show up at the scene of your crimes?"
"Always with the cracks, Sully. You're a real comedian."
"How come you're here?"
"I'm a friend of the man who owns this beautiful house."
"Then maybe you won't mind spilling his name, because the house is registered to some bogus business."
"Not at all, Sully. He's a good boy, industrious and honest. His name you can get from his lawyer, Bill Fallon, who's right over there." He pointed. "By the way, how's the police officer's retirement fund doing for dough?"
"Sorry, A.R., not this time. I'm going to have to run the kid in and put out a warrant for..."
"I told you, ask Mr. Fallon." While Sully spoke briefly to Fallon, I could see the fellow called Gura ease open the door to Rodman's room, the one behind the map of America, and let himself out. In the press of people, the police failed to notice.
"All right," announced Lieutenant Sullivan. "Let's start taking names."
The carriage trade and the party crashers began lining up. Harry whispered that he would contact my mom and get me a lawyer, but I was in no mood to be hopeful. I could just see it now. A school dropout, learning the locksmithing trade, trying to persuade the police she's on the up and up. Hadn't I broken into one apartment already? By 3 a.m., all the moths who had swarmed to the bootlegger's light were told they could leave. The only people held for further questioning were Legs Diamond and me. I later learned that Jack Legs Diamond was well known to the cops. He'd started his criminal life as a kid, snatching purses, when his fast getaways earned him the nickname Legs. Nowadays, he was known not for his sprinting ability, but for his quick temper, dangerous dealings, and senseless gunplay, all of which I attributed to his puny stature. The cops led him one way and me another, to the squad car in the custody of Lieutenant Sullivan. When I protested that I'd left all my belongings behind, he replied that he'd have someone bring them tomorrow. On the single-lane gravel drive connecting Rodman's house to the roadway, innumerable cars were trying to exit. It was a cacophonous scene. Tires spinning, horns honking, lights flashing, men and women swearing, and suddenly, metal clashing. Two cars collided. Worse, one car was blocking dozens of others and couldn't be moved. The owner had misplaced his keys. "See," he explained, "I was in a hurry and lost the key. I got into the squad car, but like everyone else, we were unable to move." "Holy moly, what do we do now?" Lieutenant Sullivan exploded. "If Palmer were here, he'd open that car as easy as a can of sardines. We can't lift it, not with all these woozy bums. Somebody's bound to get hurt." I was seated in the back seat of the squad car, bookended by two burly cops. "Maybe I can help," I said, showing off. But as soon as I yapped, I had second thoughts. If I offered to break into the car, wouldn't that prove I was a thief? But I decided that the police were smart enough to figure that anyone under a cloud wasn't about to prove she's a car breaker. "What do you know about locks?" "Can you get me a tension wrench and a straight piece of wire?" I asked. "A tension wrench we got in the tool chest. A pick too, but no wire." "Kellogg," he said to one of the bookends, "get a hanger out of the house." When Kellogg returned, Lieutenant Sullivan grabbed the toolbox and a flashlight and led me from his car to the one causing the snag. A two-step process faced me. I had to open the car and pick the starter. Lifting the hood, I took the metal hanger, straightened it out, and put a loop at the end. Running it through the clutch pedal into the car, I directed it to the door next to the driver, looped it over the handle, and pulled. Presto! The door lock released. The car had a Briggs & Stratton steering post with wafer tumblers. I sighed with relief. Heard and Yale car locks with their pin tumblers were harder to pick. With Lieutenant Sullivan training a light on the lock, I used the pick to jiggle the wafers, but wouldn't you know it, I couldn't get them to fall into line. "I didn't think so," Lieutenant Sullivan announced. "Now get in the car. I'm not giving you a chance to escape." Annoyed with myself, I replied, "Hold your horses. I'll get the job done." "If you're trying to find a way to slip out, forget it." "Sully," I said, deliberately repeating the name I'd heard his friend use, "I'll have the car running in a jiff."
"You got one more chance, kiddo."
By this time, all the drivers who wanted to leave had surrounded the car. Faces peered in through the windows, and a number of jokers were free with advice. Lieutenant Sullivan mumbled something about fishbowls and how I'd angled him into the deep. Once again, I applied the tension wrench and inserted the pick, trying not to push prematurely. Finally, the lock succumbed to my touch. The motor started at once. The owner, all smiles and smelling of cigars, swung open the driver's door. I scrambled out, but before the owner could slide in, Lieutenant Sullivan stopped him.
"I'll move it for you."
Over the man's complaints and the din, Sullivan yelled,
"Thanks, kid, but if you're innocent, how come you know so much about locks?"
The police, I concluded, weren't as smart as I thought. In the dark and confusion, someone put a hand on my arm and whispered, "Follow me." Lieutenant Sullivan's remark must have rankled because I wheeled and darted after this figure, seeing only his back. Not for one sec did I think of the consequences of running away, or of stealing Sully's tension wrench and pick, which I still had in my hands. Dodging cars, we ran down the road until we arrived at a long black sedan off to one side. "They're holding legs," my rescuer told the driver. He told me to get in, then he turned to face me. It was the man from the library, the man Lieutenant Sullivan had called A.R. The driver, elegantly dressed in a white chauffeur's uniform, wheeled the car in front of others, causing a clamorous outburst of horns, and joined the procession driving away from Rodman's estate. I sat watching and waiting. "Don't worry, miss," A.R. said. Sol is so far to the rear, he'd have to sprout wings to overtake us. I could hear a bullhorn commanding all cars to stop, and out the window I could see flashlights making holes in the dark, but none of the cars in front of us stopped. In a few minutes, the sedan, kicking up gravel, wheeled onto the cement and flew into the early morning light, headed, as AR explained, for Vineland, New Jersey, and a hideout that all the mugs used. The home of Nathan Baritsky, a forger and glassworker living on Delsey Drive.